Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We still have plenty of seats, so if you're lingering in the hall, now is the time to come in. It is just after 2 o'clock. My name is Dr. Dan Webb, and thank you for attending session number 358 of Sunstone, titled Hashtag Mormon Me Too, Healing the Church and Strengthening Our Community. I invite you at this time, and it is more than an invitation, to silence electronic devices, especially cell phones. As you listen today, we invite you to explore what it means to be Mormon. We ask you to reflect on your own Mormon interactions and to hold the good and the bad together to create a fuller, more complete narrative. In doing this, we allow others to do the same. We remind you that this session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desks. Please consider purchasing other Sunstone merchandise to support Sunstone, or perhaps by making a donation. As a courtesy to other presenters and attendees, this session will end promptly at 3:30. We anticipate the discussion will be lively up to that point. We invite you all at 3:30 to continue the discussion in the hall so that preparations can begin for the next session. This panel will explain the culture of handling abuse in the Mormon community. When the time comes for a question and answer period, please proceed in an orderly manner to behind that central microphone, forming one single row so we know the proper order of the questions. At this time, I turn the time over to our distinguished panelists.
We want to welcome everybody, and we are so very, very excited and humbled to be able to speak to you about this issue. We are going to turn the spotlight on introductions right now, and we have a survivor of trauma and abuse that is going to speak to you firsthand.
There we go. Hi, my name is Christine Burton. I am a religious abuse and trauma survivor. I've been hiding in the shadows of silence for many years. As I talk, I think you'll be able to realize why. I'm going to be discussing a couple of traits, a couple of beliefs, and just have you walk through this with me, and I think you'll be able to see that all was very much the same then as it is now when it comes to behavior, which I think is vital for what we're doing. I think the church has changed in a lot of very important ways, but I think it's more logistic ways and administrative ways, and what really concerns me is it hasn't changed so much in behaviors and emotions and compassion. So the very first thing I want to talk about is perfectionism. That was alive and well in my life over 5 decades ago when this began. That was more important than anything, and it was toxic. I think if you kind of think about it today, it may not have changed quite as much as we would like it to have. To my parents, what was most important to them was their reputation. What people thought of them, that was paramount. I was told that I was very special, that I was blessed, and I was very lucky. I came from a very rich Mormon heritage, and I was even told that I was actually better than other people. At the same time I was being told this, I had a little calendar by my bed upstairs, and every day that I survived the day, I put a check. I never knew whether I was going to live through the day. Oftentimes, I would pray and pour out my soul to Heavenly Father, please, please, let me live until Christmas. Let me live until my birthday. At the same time, this was in Federal Heights, so you can see it's an upscale neighborhood of Salt Lake. All that was going on, my parents had very prominent positions and also personal relationships and also business relationships which allowed our house to be kind of a meeting place for various people in the community. This consisted of prophets. This consisted of soon-to-be prophets. This consisted of apostles, governors of the state, professors of the University of Utah, where my father taught. All of these people would be coming in and out, talking to my parents about various goals, various happenings that would be occurring. At that time, my father was manager of the Deseret News, so we had to meet with these people all of the time. They would come in our home, and I often would be bruised and cut and have black eye. The only comments I would get would be, "Gosh, Christy," that was my name because my mother's name was Christine, "what happened to you?" And I would look at my mother and say, "I fell," or "I fell off my bike." Those were the only things I would be allowed to say. Sorry, this can get very emotional for me. In order to keep this perfectionist facade intact, one also had to deny reality. That'll be another little thing we're talking about for a second. Denying my reality of the horrendous happenings that occurred to me in my home. Denying the feelings that surrounded that reality. No, you're not hurt. No, you can't cry. No, you can't feel like that. No, that's a wrong feeling. No, you're not allowed to say you have to pee. No, you're not allowed to say you're hungry. The era of the don't tell, don't ask, don't feel, and don't talk was very alive and well. And I think in many instances it's still alive and well. This was the most important aspect of their life. I'm going to talk really quickly about certain people without going into great detail, but I'm going to be very respectful. President Monson, who I knew by Tom because he was in our home a lot. He was a student of my father at the University of Utah. And then when my father went to Deseret News, he took Tom Monson as an employee. So he was in our home many, many times. And I remember trying to talk to him once. I remember him asking my mother, asking me, "What did you do today? What did you do as fun?" And my mother immediately said she was outside playing with her friends. And in actuality, I had been locked in a closet the entire day. So denying reality was actually huge. What they told me was the most important thing. I remember sitting in a darkened living room as this beautiful blessing was given to my niece, who was riddled with cancer at age 3. This was given by Spencer W. Kimball. He came into the room. We pulled all the shades down. I sat in the back. As I listened to this prayer, beautiful prayer, I remember thinking, if I open my eyes, I will know that I will see Jesus standing there. And then I stopped myself and thought, oh, no, no, Jesus doesn't love me. I'm a bad person. I'm a bad child. Jesus can't appear to me. Because, you see, my parents were so revered and so honored by everyone that it had to be my problem. I'm a little child who's very ego-centered. It had to be my problem. I was evil. I was bad. I had to be extinguished. I had 3 suicide attempts before I was 12 years old. I remember President McKay calling my mother one day. She was involved with decorating his house. She was involved with Nauvoo Restoration, the Heber C. Kimball home, Brigham Young home down in St. George. And she was decorating President McKay's home on South Temple when they lived in their private homes. He called one day to wish her a happy birthday, and I answered. And he said, "Christy, I just want you to know, outside of my mother and my wife, your mother is the most Christ-like person that I know." please always honor, respect, and revere her. The same time, I received my patriarchal blessing, which also said the same. Honor your parents the days of your life. Do good by them, and you will be blessed by God. That was torn up about 3 years ago, actually. So I am saying this to show that these things are still alive and well today. And if we are to deal with trauma in the church, we have to be real. We have to talk about things. We have to share. People have to come out of the shadows, and we have to listen. We cannot hide. We cannot continue to give whitewashed answers to things that aren't really true. We have to tell the truth, or nothing will go forward as far as I'm concerned. This is happening 5 decades ago, and nothing much has changed in my mind as far as behavior. This cannot go on. We have to be validated in our feelings. Abuse survivors have to be vindicated, and they have to be given a voice. Those are the 3 V's that I never received. I will do anything in my power any day to help other people express their truth, come out of the shadows, own their reality, and defend their reality. Nothing matters more than that. Thank you very much.
My name is Nicole Jensen, and I'm so grateful that Christine could come and share her story. So I'm going to skip over a lot of my story simply because I want to talk about the advocacy. But I will just mention that I grew up in the church. I kind of did everything right, quote unquote, according to how we are raised and the things that we're supposed to do. You know, I was like the class president in the Beehives and the Maya Maid and the Laurels, and I was an EFY counselor, and I got married in the temple, and yet I was abused by my older brother sexually and physically and psychologically for my entire life from the time I was 3 years old through, you know, my teenage years. My brother is, his name is Rucker Leifson. And he's involved in an old murder that happened here in Spanish Fork. So he's just this bad guy, you know, not a really great guy. And yet, he was very good at keeping his behavior quiet under the radar. And you know, in echoing what Christine shared, one of the things that I experienced growing up, I was always very vocal. I just didn't know how to articulate exactly what was happening and why I was unhappy. You know, my mother was also very emotionally abusive. She protected him and kind of turned me into the scapegoat. And so even though I grew up in the church and I always felt that God was real and that he was with me, I had a lot of conflict, you know, trying to reconcile what was happening to me with the love that I felt from God and the culture and the doctrine that existed in the church. After I got married and I became a mother, I kind of kicked my healing into high gear. That's when I acknowledged to myself that the way that I had been treated growing up was actually abuse. And so over the next several years, I worked hard to heal, and I worked hard to protect my children and to raise them in a way that created an environment where I was an approachable parent, so that if anything ever happened to them, if they were molested or somebody, you know, touched them inappropriately, first of all, they would know that what had happened to them was not okay, that their body was their own, and that they would feel safe coming and talking to me and telling me what happened. And when my youngest daughter was 3 years old, that exact scenario actually did happen. And my husband and I, we were very aware and cautious about, leaving our kids around my brother or around his kids. And my family was, they were very unhappy that I had stood up and I had said, this is what happened, this is what's been happening, this is wrong. They wanted me to continue being that perfect Relief Society president and sit down and shut up and talk about all the good stuff and not about the bad stuff. And in my mind, it was very important that we acknowledged what happened so that we could prevent it from happening. In the church, we talk about the importance of having a forever family. You know, it's one of the main things in the church that really keeps people motivated. It keeps them going to church. It keeps them striving for that temple marriage and all of those boxes that we are taught to check, because we want to have a forever family. And yet, in my case, and I would just have to add that with Christine's story and in my advocacy over the past several years, I have heard hundreds of stories just like her. This is not a unique story. These are not unique circumstances. And for myself, I was sure that I could heal from my own abuse, protect my children, and still have that forever family with my parents and my brothers. And I almost died trying to make it happen. I almost died because their efforts to silence me and the victim blaming and all of what is called secondary wounding for survivors is incredibly painful and incredibly traumatic. And so to be living in a home and, you know, with my parents and with my husband's parents and the way that things moved forward, it just didn't provide the kind of environment to heal and to have a forever family. And really, who wants to have a forever family if that family is abusive and dysfunctional? And yet in the church, you know, this is one of the thinking errors that we see all the time. You know, we talk about the doctrine and we talk about certain parts of the doctrine. Jesus Christ is not okay with abuse of children. He is not okay with them being hurt. He is not okay with dishonesty and deception and covering and protecting sexual predators. He is not okay with this. In 2013, I found out that my in-laws and my parents had kind of band together with my husband. He'd retained an attorney 6 months previous to when I discovered that he was filing for divorce. And in that moment, I felt like God kind of picked me up, woke me up, and said, enough is enough. And so I went through a lot, and I felt very alone. And so at that point, I reached out and established an advocacy online where I was working and directly seeking to offer support to other people who were going through the same thing, because I didn't want people to feel alone. And so I had a group called LDS Adult Survivors of Childhood Abuse. And my goal has always been to help people heal from their abuse with the gospel. And, you know, there are certain aspects of the gospel which support the fact that we shouldn't be allowing abuse. And one of these things comes from a book that was published by the BYU School of Family Life. And this quote right here supports the need for boundaries. And it says, ultimately, healing from abuse in the Lord's way involves leaving behind false and destructive family beliefs, traditions, loyalties, or even ties when they serve to disregard the sanctity of life. When one has the power, mentally and physically, to protect oneself or other vulnerable people, one has the right and the responsibility to do so, even if it means the disruption of family relationships. In no instance has the Lord decreed that we should tolerate ongoing abuse or to resign ourselves to a lifetime of unrighteous demands from those who should care for us. And that applies to our family, and that applies to our church leaders. And so for years, you know, I worked with women and I worked with men to help them see this. And then on April 5th, you did this. Everything shifted. When McKenna came forward, I'm sorry for being emotional. You know, for my entire life, all these years I spent trying to help other people, I believed the problem was just in families, that it was one family at a time that needed to confront the abuse. And when she came forward And when Ryan McKnight introduced us, and I was able to talk to her and feel and know for myself that she is honest and she is brave and that she is trying to expose things that are wrong in the church, I knew at that moment that the problem was much bigger than I had ever anticipated. And so working with McKenna and Rebecca Wheeler-Rose, who is unable to be here today, and with Leslie, we established our Mormon Me Too group on Facebook to provide a platform for survivors. We start by believing, and we offer information, candor with compassion, because we have to be honest. We cannot continue to follow the same cultural norms of sustaining our leaders over the morality of speaking up against abuse and protecting our children. And that is what we are doing. This is our mission statement that I am not going to read because I want everyone to have a chance to explain their story. But what I do want to emphasize is I love Jesus Christ, and I know that the church has good things to offer. But I have seen over my lifetime and in working with hundreds of survivors that people's souls are dying in the church. They are dying. They are in so much pain because there is not validation and there is not support, and they do not have the safety to express how the things that are coming out in the media are affecting their faith. In my group that I originally established, it was active, and the women and the men would support each other, and they would talk. And when McKenna came forward, suddenly everyone was silent, because it has caused a faith crisis for countless men and women in this church, and we have to change it. And I believe that we can, and we will continue working together to do that. So thank you.
My name is Sam Young. I'm from Houston, Texas. Active member of the church. Have been my whole life. Served in all the traditional callings, including a bishop for 5 years. Now, what got me interested in what I am doing? So I've also started a movement, an organization called Protect LDS Children, or Protect the Children. I got started in this a couple of years ago. I talked to my stake president when I heard that there were interviews about masturbation, but I just didn't think that was right. But my wheels weren't spinning yet. Nothing was engaged until last year, in March of last year, a fellow that I'd home taught for a long time said, "Sam, I think it's time I tell you why I don't go to church." And we sat on his porch, and he explained this story. He said that he and his wife had decided to take their young kids to church to be part of the youth program. One day, his 14-year-old came to him and said, "Dad, the bishop's asked me to talk to him, and I'm nervous about that." His dad said, "No worry, I'll just sit on the couch. Any problems, you just walk out the door, I'm there." Well, a few minutes later, his son came rushing out, white as a ghost, said, "Dad, the bishop asked me if I masturbate or if I have sex with other boys." This friend of mine stood up, walked in that bishop's office, and said, "If you ever ask my children anything like that again, I will beat you to a pulp." I was not a dad like that. I wish I had been the dad like him. So he told me that, and now my wheels are starting to spin. Is this common out there? And so he didn't come back to church, but his children were my youngest children's age. I've got 6 daughters. So I put it out on the internet, just asking, is this a common practice? Has it happened to anybody? I was flooded with stories of people being not just asked about masturbation. You'd think that would be horrid enough that we ask about masturbation. But then you find out all these other things that have been asked of children. And then you find out all the damage. And some of these folks have been involved with this for ages, or are victims of all this stuff. I don't even know this stuff is going on. I didn't know all the damages, dreadful damages that happened to our children because of the bishops interviews the way they're handled today. So I was flooded with it. A couple months later, decided, finally, I'm going to ask one of my daughters. And if I'd never pronounced that word in my house before, masturbation, now it rolls off my tongue. So I asked one of my daughters that grew up in this the same time as this kid if she had ever been asked that question. She said, yes, Dad, when I was 12. And I didn't know what it was, so I asked my friends. They didn't know what it was, so I Googled it. And, Dad, I found out what masturbation was, how to do it, and I found pornography. So the bishop had introduced my child to sexual practices. Now, maybe she was ready for it, maybe she wasn't, but it was certainly highly inappropriate. I was incensed to find that out. I got a little lion as the logo of our deal. I was incensed to find out that I've always been super dedicated to the callings that I have. You see what I'm doing here? I've always done that in every single calling that I've done. So there I felt, here I am, dedicated my life to the church, sacrificing all kinds of things, and they took my children behind closed doors and asked them if they masturbated. That is dead wrong. That got me engaged. Yeah. So I thought it would be a no-brainer to tell the world, to tell my ward, to tell my bishop, my stake president, we shouldn't be doing this. Did you know we're doing this? We shouldn't be doing it. Oh, my goodness, it's not a no-brainer, okay? It's a no-brainer for everybody outside of the church, but it's not a no-brainer to many members in the church. I'm finding out many members of the church don't like this policy but can't speak up about it because we have a culture of fear. You don't question. You don't make a statement that's opposed to some crappy policy. Anyway, that's what got me started, and for this last year, it's been a tremendously interesting, gut-wrenching journey. Christine mentioned having a voice. I have read thousands of stories of horror that we've done to our kids. I'm working to get that damn policy changed. I don't know what else I can do. I've just embarked on another deal as of last night. But I'm working to give voice to all those who've been harmed and get this thing changed so my grandkids, Tom's grandkids, are not harmed going forward.
It's hard to follow such great people and to be on the same panel as such powerful and strong spirits. My name is McKenna Denson. Some of you know who I am, some of you don't, so I don't have a lot to say today. But I'm going to tell you, I'm the woman that is suing the church in federal court for covering up the rape that happened in the MTC by the mission president. He raped me. He had a little rape room in the basement of the MTC with a bed and a TV and a VCR. I flew to his home in Arizona in December, and I recorded it was kind of a confession, but he had verbal diarrhea, and he just kept talking about these other women that he had assaulted. He talked about revealing his predatory behavior to a general authority named Robert E. Wells. And my very good friend, Rebecca Wheeler-Rose, helped me understand that Joseph Bishop is a narcissist. So she allowed me the opportunity by teaching me about narcissism, how to open the door to Joseph Bishop to get him to feel comfortable and free. He felt so free. He just kept going on and on for 2 hours and 44 minutes. So we have a case against the court, or against the corporation of the president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and Joseph Layton Bishop for fraud, because the church knew he was a sexual predator at least at the time that he was mission president in Argentina, where he assaulted some of his sisters. And then they promoted him and made him mission president of the flagship missionary training center in Provo, Utah. So that's my story. After I had my press conference, I've had hundreds and hundreds of men and women telling their stories. I was able to meet Sam Young, and I only have a very short Sam Young story, and it's not really a Sam Young story, but it's my Protect the LDS Children story. Some of you know, some of you don't, but I had a violently sexually abusive stepfather. He was a horrible, horrible man. And when I was getting ready for my baptismal interview, I was 15. I was going to be baptized on my 16th birthday. The ward mission leader did my interview, and he asked if I masturbated. I didn't know what that was. If he'd said, "Do you touch yourself and pleasure yourself?" I'd have said, "Oh, yeah." But that's not what he said. He asked if I masturbated. I didn't know what that was. And then he asked me if I enjoyed what my stepfather did to me. And I thought, okay, it gave me pause. It truly gave me pause. But I didn't know that wasn't right. I thought he was a man of God, just like the mission president was a man of God. I thought God was asking me those questions. So I almost didn't get baptized because I didn't know how to answer that question. So this is my story. This is why I'm standing here today. The church has tried to discredit me. Bless them. They filed a motion to dismiss our case, which is normal procedure. But I am not backing down. I am not standing down. We will go as far as the Supreme Court, as far as I'm concerned. So we have to have a voice. Thank you. We have to have a voice. And it doesn't matter if you're a survivor or a victim. If you just find your inner voice and just tell your partner or just tell somebody, because what I have found is that the minute you speak your truth, you start to heal. So thank you all for this support. And also look it up online and feel free and empowered. Support our Me Too movement because it's all inclusive. Thank you.
I'm Leslie Butterfield. I come from a long, rich history of Mormon pioneers, and I even have an ancestor that's mentioned by name in the Doctrine and Covenants. I'm very proud of that legacy, and that's given me, as proud as I am of it, it also has given me some great pain in my life, which I hopefully can describe eloquently enough. I am a survivor of domestic abuse, and kind of stepping back from the sexual abuse and the grooming practices of the church, I want to talk a little bit about domestic abuse and how it's handled in the church. About 2 years ago, I went to my bishop and described situations of abuse in my home. I didn't call it that because I didn't know that that's what it was. Some of the situations I described were being left on the side of the road in front of my children several times, being stranded places, money being withdrawn out of our bank account so I couldn't buy groceries, I couldn't go places I needed to be, being shamed for wanting to work, wanting to further my education, being called horrific names in front of my four small children daily. So when I went and described these things to my bishop, I was really looking for guidance and comfort and advocacy because I knew that these things were wrong. What I got instead was I was told to be a better wife and a better mother, and stop being selfish. I was told that I needed to please my husband more. My bishop then went into asking me my sexual history as a teenager. I was a 35-year-old woman at the time. He told me several problematic things during the time that I met with him, and finally, of my own volition, I finally realized I don't have to stay here anymore. Something is very wrong. And I didn't even have the words or the foresight to know what it was. but I knew that something was very wrong. I left his office in tears. I immediately called a family member and explained to her what had happened. I then spoke the subsequent days to someone who's a prominent Mormon feminist, and she completely validated my feelings and told me, you know, this is ecclesiastical abuse, what you've experienced. This is spiritual abuse. And she just listened and validated. And that brought me such great comfort in a time that was so confusing for me. The abuse in my home quickly escalated, and I actually left with my four small children a few months after that. I could see how the enablement of the bishop really enabled the abuse in my home. I could see how that was inextricably linked together, and it was kind of like a green light and a pass for that abuse to happen. When I left, I attended a women's support group in a very Mormon influenced community. And in that support group, I began to hear stories of ecclesiastical abuse, particularly with domestic violence survivors. And I began to see there is a huge problem with when survivors seek help from their bishop, because oftentimes that is the first contact point. That is the first person that you can go contact safely in an abusive situation. Your abuser often won't question that, and I think that there's a reason for that as well. But I began to see that it is a huge problem, and sort of sharing my story online in different discussion groups, there was an outpouring, really, of Me Too, Me Too, Me Too, Me Too, of people, women in particular, and men, that had gone to seek help for abuse from their bishops, and it wasn't recognized, it was enabled, and oftentimes condoned. And fast forward a few months, I started a website just with stories I had been hearing, a website for people to anonymously and safely share their stories of ecclesiastical abuse, specifically within the church. I've gotten dozens of stories. I keep getting more. I just got four yesterday. And they range in all sorts of different situations, from the domestic abuse situation to the sexual abuse situation to abuse in LDS employment to traumatization by other church members even. And I can see how the building blocks are such that there needs to be a way to address specifically spiritual abuse within the church as that relates to ecclesiastical abuse. And in all of these situations, spiritual abuse, ecclesiastical abuse is a common thread in many of them. And when you experience it, you oftentimes don't even think to question it, because we're told that these men are called of God and they have the spirit of discernment. And even after I experienced my spiritual abuse and ecclesiastical abuse, I even went to the stake president, which was also problematic because he was the man who called the bishop into his calling. And so it kind of calls into question his own authority, priesthood authority, and his own spirit of discernment. So there is a big conflict there. And that's kind of where my advocacy has led me. I'm a nurse in real life, and I'm a mother. And if you would have told me a year ago that I would have been here with all of you wonderful people at Sunstone speaking about my story, and with all of these wonderful advocates, I would have never, ever believed you. But great things can happen when you own your story and you own your truth and you speak out for what you know is right and what you know is wrong. And that's my bit. So Dana is going to give us a little rundown of church trauma and introduce herself.
I'm Dana Hartline, and I also have a story, but I'm here to talk about church trauma. So just a tiny bit of background about me. I am the founder and creator of the Mormon Trauma Mama, which is a website that addresses church trauma and healing. I have an incredibly gifted team that works with me. We also have a Facebook group called LDS Church Trauma and Healing. Earlier this year, I did a presentation at the Joseph Smith Memorial Building on understanding and managing church trauma, which can be found on YouTube by typing in my name, or even just church trauma. It can also be found on my website. My team and I are also organizing an invitation-only summit this fall called When Church Hurts. We are bringing together some of the top minds in this movement to collaborate and support each other in this movement to draw awareness to the very real effects of church trauma in the LDS Church. Church trauma is a largely uncharted area of investigation that is just beginning to grab the attention of researchers. It may be even a term you haven't heard. So we need to ask the question, what even is church trauma? Before I give you a formal definition, I would like to have us all visualize something. And I thought about having us go to Nevada, where this happened just this week, but I thought that was a little too close to home. So instead, I'd like us all to go mentally to Aurora, Colorado. The date is July 20th, 2012. You are at the midnight showing of the movie Batman. Do you remember this night? This is the night that the 24-year-old white man, who had colored his hair Kool-Aid orange and red, looked like the Joker in the movie Batman, opened gunfire, killing 24 and wounding 58. I want you to imagine you were among that number. Imagine after having been shot, you had to go back into that building every single week, sometimes more than once a week, with the gunman still there. Imagine that when you go into that building, the people attending the theater oddly know nothing about the shooting that has occurred, and of course that you had been shot. Imagine further that it's an event that cannot be disclosed to anyone either. And because it cannot be disclosed, instead of receiving the so much needed medical support, everyone instead questions you and wonders about you. You want to share it with them, but you know it's not safe. One of the reasons it's not safe is the gunman is still there. He is there every time you go. Going back into that building is so not desired, but you know you must go. You have to go for your family. You have to go because, ironically, the living water is said to be found within the theater. Your heart burns for him. And so you go. You feel so ashamed, embarrassed, and confused that you were shot and multiple times and that you are struggling because of it. You struggle with anger that people, in their ignorance, won't back up, giving you psychological air because they have no understanding of what you have undergone. You struggle with intense anxiety for fear that you're going to run into the gunman unexpectedly, although you are on constant outlook so that such will not happen. You struggle with intense self-hatred because you fear and even believe that you deserved to be shot. Now compare that to a location where religious teachings are present. It doesn't have to be a church building. And so the formal definition of church trauma is a condition of serious psychological damage that occurs as the result of religion or faith. It's the vile, noxious, and icky aftermath of intense spiritual injury. Now, when we're talking about church trauma, we need to first understand that trauma is not the same as offense. We hear so much about offense in our church. We've been taught well that we choose to be offended. But offense is not the only level of hurt. There's also trauma. And people do not choose to be traumatized. One does not choose to be robbed or assaulted or shot. And trauma must be treated differently than offense, just like a slap must be treated differently than a deep, oozing cut. And if there's any group of people in or out of this church that need more sensitivity and understanding, it is this group of people. But I'm not just talking about obvious trauma, which can readily be recognized and seen. In addition to obvious trauma, there is also invisible, psychological, spiritual trauma. All trauma is very difficult to deal with, to say the least. People are not the same again after such experiences and violations. And equally traumatizing is invisible trauma. And yes, invisible trauma can even show its vicious tentacles at church And it can come in so many forms, which we will be talking about more today. But Leslie wanted me to give you a little more basis on church trauma. So Benjamin Corey said this, "Church trauma runs deep because it cuts into our identity. When we want to be good, when we legitimately want to do the right thing, and when someone shows us that we're not very good at it, it messes with our concept of self. Given enough pragmatic trauma or even one serious incident, people walk away. They get discouraged, depressed, and hurt, and they walk away. Sometimes they appear to walk away from God entirely, which only encourages people to lovingly point out all over again that they suck at being a Christian, which those of us who embrace authenticity already know. However, usually the case isn't at all that they've walked away from God. It's simply that they've just walked away from the organization associated with those who have harmed them. People who have walked away because of church trauma will often externally appear resentful or even hostile toward anything that appears too righteous to them, while internally they still want to follow God and long to connect with him in deeper and more meaningful ways. Church, ironically, becomes a barrier, when in reality it should be a gateway. Now, when we consider this ache that too many experience at church, we need to keep in mind and understand that what is trauma to one may not be trauma to another. We are all on different planes and tolerance levels, and those vary from person to person and from time and situation, even among those same individuals. If you are going through a physical difficulty, for example, I just got back from trek, so that comes to mind, and an intense emotional injury hits on top of that, you're more likely to experience trauma rather than offense, and if all else is going well in your life. We must not be rigid or simple-minded in our thinking and understanding of this. We cannot just think that someone is weaker or has less faith or is more problematic because something traumatizes one and not the other. Timing and situations matter. I also want to point out something that may seem obvious. The way we treat strugglers in this church is of crucial importance. I say that because I hear so many sentiments that insinuate the opposite. It's your fault if you're not happy at church, or suck it up sentiments. But in our church, if we are not careful, the treatment is vital, because what often starts as a mistreatment issue can quickly turn into a doctrinal issue. And if there is any religion that struggles with handling its church history, it's ours. So if we are not careful, we can unwittingly throw people onto an arduous journey where they are not only dealing with mistreatment, but also hard-to-swallow elements from our church history. The reverse can also be true. People can have legitimate questions and concerns about policy or church history, and it can quickly turn into a mistreatment issue. The way we treat strugglers in this church is of crucial importance. Further, those who have church trauma line up pretty squarely with the DSM-5 criteria for PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome, which includes, some of the symptoms include depression, hypervigilance, anxiety, flashbacks, extreme reactions to memories of the trauma, avoidance, loss of memory, detachment, disinterest, insomnia, and loss of confidence. Now, the tendency is for people to want to diminish any kind of trauma that isn't combat trauma. But let's be very clear here. In combat trauma, soldiers go in expecting battle. They go in trained to see an enemy. And so when they go in and they come home with trauma, we give allowances for them. We're trained. We understand. We back up and we get them immediate help. But with church trauma, one is being violated and betrayed by those who were thought and expected to be safe. A church leader, a family member, a friend, a defender, a helper. And in church trauma, no one wants to accept it and admit it. And we think, right, nothing seriously can happen in the Mormon church, right? And those wounds can be hidden as well. And we can also see that the victims, they don't understand what's happened to them either. They're often just as confused. And because no one gets it, the hurt and the blame gets thrown right back onto those who are traumatized, causing greater cognitive dissonance, which increases just their fear and their confusion. When trauma comes from the hands from those who were thought and expected to be safe, our whole neurological system is thrown into chaos. In fact, research shows that those who have psychological trauma, the effects are longer lasting and more detrimental than combat trauma. Further studies show that up to 20% of those who have been mobbed at church commit suicide. So let me define mobbing. Mobbing is hostile and unethical communication, which is directed in a systematic way by one or a few individuals. The individual is pushed into a defenseless position and held there by means of continued mobbing activities. Mobbing activities can include several things, which I'm not going to take the time to go into unless there's time later. But let me give you some more statistics. 64% of families who experience church trauma feel forced to relocate. I'm among that number. 66% of children are forced to change schools. 67% of family members of church trauma victims report experiencing detrimental effects on family well-being and physical health. Another number is 71% of women who are married to sex addicts also meet the criteria for PTSD. So one article on PTSD states, one great trauma imposer seems to be when it comes from authoritarian figureheads. Perhaps the hardship of this type of trauma comes from what Sigmund Freud observed as a common illusion of a father surrogate that loves all of the individuals in the group equally. To add to the conflict, members of such group believing the surrogate father illusion will often call into question the trustworthiness of trauma victims. And in support of the authority figure, quickly diminishes the reports of the traumatized, leaving them without a sense of their own personal worth and identity. In addition, churchgoers often look to elders and ministers in their churches as father figures. Trauma from this source can be particularly harmful, as many members feel that their church leaders are closer to God than all others. Hence, this can be particularly distressing for when people are abused by clergy or other adults within the church, as there may be additional ramifications because they are being violated by individuals who allegedly represent forgiveness, love, and trust at its best. Sadly, too often, trauma violates prior explanations of or meanings of life. Thus, if victims are not careful, trauma can be a great destroyer of dreams, of religious faith, and of spiritual practice. In addition, traumatic reminders of actual events may occur by just attending church or even seeing congregation members that echo the trauma, thus causing re-traumatization. Such violations generate immense emotional and spiritual distress, not only for victims and their families, but also can cause great harm for anyone associated with that church. So I have developed here an illustration that shows how trauma often looks for those suffering from the Mormon Me Too movement. And it starts in the roots. So we have organizational behavior, theology over morality, unrighteous dominion, unsafe policies, cultural behaviors, unethical councils, patriarchal structure, and grooming practices. Now these are the causal factors of trauma that we will be discussing during our panel discussion. But it's important to look at the consequences of these traumatic situations that happen as the result of what is in the roots. So we have cognitive dissonance. When it comes to church, too often religious organizations and their leaders are deemed incapable of inflicting trauma or any kind of religious wrongdoing. So when abuse does occur, severe cognitive dissonance will arise within the victim because they struggle between the horrors of what happened to them and their belief that clergy can do no harm because of their divine authority. And so in attempts to resolve the dissonance, the victim will blame themselves. And this is often reinforced by the perpetuators' affirmative statements and so many others in the church. They will tell you it's your fault. And so too often in their attempts to meet community or to feel connected to God, they just internalize that abuse. And so they adopt the belief that they are sinful and the perpetuator is good. And this cognitive dissonance comes at a price where they adopt that self-loathing and that criticism for a circumstance that is completely beyond their control. And so there we have church exodus. And this is because the church, which is we are taught, is a hospital, a place where you go to get well. We are told that by many of our leaders. Instead of it being that, it lacks safety. It's not a place of healing. It's a place of trauma, a place that causes an emotional uproar just to enter. And so for the sake of the mental, emotional, and spiritual well-being, the people will walk away. And the next one we have is disassociation. And we may think this is the same as church exodus, which it can be. But because of the teachings of our church, there is no viable reason to leave. And so people have to stay, they feel. And so they do whatever they can, which is often to disassociate. And they disassociate not just with the members, but with themselves. And they say, this isn't real. I'm not really here. That person isn't really here. And we see this all the time at church. And we're like, why can't that person function? Why aren't they acting this way? Well, maybe we need to get down to the roots and really look at why they are disassociating. What is happening? So the next one that we have is abuser loyalty. And at this point, I want to explain that everybody's branches are going to look different, because everyone internalizes trauma differently. But this one says to just do better, to be better. It's the, I'm not good enough, so I'll just fake it until I make it. Or it's all my fault voice. And so the traumatized, they just try to sidle up with their abusers. They want to fit in, to look like, act like, serve like, be like their abuser, to pretend that all is well in Zion. So they serve a little harder, smile a little bigger, and butter up just a little bit more. The next is loss of identity. Trauma messes with concept of self. They aren't sure who they are anymore. This church is often all they have ever known, and yet the religion isn't working for them, and they cannot seem to make it fit. And often, members are helping them with this, too, because they are getting labels attached to them. They are told that they are insufficient, and they're apostates, or you can imagine the things that victims are told, and it's always their fault. And rather than being treated as a sufferer of the problem, they are treated as if they are the cause of the problem, because all there is offense, right? That's all we know. So it's their problem, and they don't know what to do. They have a loss of identity. So there we have mental disorders. Too often what we are doing is we are treating the symptoms of trauma. We're treating depression. We're treating anxiety. We're treating OCD. But until we get down to the roots, the causal effects of trauma, we are only applying band-aids. In fact, research shows that all mental illnesses, that's a big word, all, what it is it is trauma. It is PTSD. We are dealing with PTSD. And so the church needs to look at this influx that we have with mental illnesses. Utah, which is what, 70% Mormon, is ranked number one in the nation with mental illnesses. Let's get out of the branches, shall we? And let's get down to the roots. Why are we having this problem with so much mental illness in our church? So there we have the next one is family dysfunction. Let us be very clear. When we are talking about trauma, we are talking about families. No man is an island. When you hit a mother, you have hit a family. And too often this is generational. There's so much trauma in our church history. It comes right from the onset, particularly with women, children, and minorities. And research shows that children vicariously connect with the pain and suffering of their parents. And so it is being passed down from generation to generation. I don't think we realize how prevalent this is. When you are having from generation to generation, you're having grief and you're having depression and anxiety. It's just being passed down all the way. We need to get down to what's really going on, because many have STS, secondary traumatic stress, which you have adopted from your parents, and it's your geographs will show this. And further studies show, this should concern us, that in environments where a mother is being mistreated, the children are being treated likewise. So the last one on there is shame. Very much, we live in a shame and tame culture in the LDS Church. We kind of like guilt. We kind of like perfectionism because it keeps us in line. It keeps us guilty. We are the ones who are responsible because it's always offense. And so too often, rather than embracing and hearing and validating these people who have church trauma, we are shaming them. So we're going to see suicide. Utah is ranked the 8th happiest state in the nation. There is a lot of happiness here in Utah. But whenever you have a lot of happiness, research shows, when I did my graduate studies on this, there's going to be a counter response. Utah is 5th in the nation with suicide. So when you find that there's happiness all around you and you can't seem to fit the mold, that bar's too high and you can't seem to reach it, and people are telling you you're insufficient and you're not good enough for it anyway, there's going to be that counter response. There's going to be more suicide. A 2001 study showed that the number one cause of suicide among LDS boys was masturbation shaming. And for LDS girls, it was losing their virginity or having a baby out of wedlock. If we really care about the well-being of our members, we need to get down to the roots, which is what we are going to do right now.
Wow. All right, real quick, we are going to pose a couple of questions to the panel. The first one, which aspects that from the trauma tree that we see behind us of the culture and system in the church could you touch on that or explain further that lead to the enablement of abuse? Real quick, I am going to touch on the patriarchal structure within the church. Oftentimes you don't know that this is a problem until it becomes a problem for you. Our families are set up this way. Our government is set up this way. Our church is set up this way. Society as a whole is set up this way, I think. And we've kind of become conditioned to thinking that it is normal, and it's become normalized. In the church, it's very unique because we have a system of benevolent patriarchy. We adopt a complementarianism model, which is basically the men have the authority over the families, but they're supposed to have this sort of sacrificial authority and sacrificially lead their families. That becomes problematic because the men are still the leaders. The men are still the decision makers. They're still the office holders, the authority figures within the system. And so even though it's benevolent, where we're protecting the women and the children, and we're making the decisions for their benefit because we love them so much, it's still problematic. It's still not ethical because women are not represented in that structure to make the decisions or to influence even the decisions or policies that would make the system safer for them. So a couple of quick statistics. 1 in 3 women, 1 in 4 men experience some form of abuse in their lifetime. Sex abuse is number one in religious churches as to why they end up in the court system. So sex abuse, number one, as to why religions end up in the court system, end up with legal ramifications when they face legal ramifications. Something that we get from patriarchy, we get rape culture. You might have heard that term. That's sort of when the moral authority comes from males, they sort of center it upon the teachings that are amenable to them. And we see things like don't get raped instead of don't rape. And we see things like
don't breastfeed without a cover. Instead of control your own thoughts when you see a mother breastfeeding. Okay, so those things are very problematic, and it's very much adopted into the language in the church, the structure in the church, and the system in the church. And until we start to dismantle that, I don't even like that word, but incorporate more females and more diversity, more inclusion into the leadership structure that can make policies, make decisions, have authority in the structure, then we are going to get more of the rape culture. And I don't know a better word for that, I apologize. But we are going to get more of those things where it's blaming the women, blaming victims, and not placing the responsibility where it needs to be. We are going to go to McKenna.
Thank you. So I just want to talk real briefly about grooming. I think many of you know what that means and what it looks like. But for those of you who don't, grooming in the church and grooming outside the church, grooming people for sexual assault, a lot of times it begins with making someone feel special, feel like they're extraordinary, to feel like they are amazing. So the perpetrator... Because I'm only, my niche is sexual assault. I don't have anything else to really discuss, so this is just where I'm going to go with this. If it makes you uncomfortable, I apologize. But perpetrators tend to make their victims feel special, and they try to make them feel like the perpetrator is trustworthy and trusting. And so there are certain things to look out for, and you can look out for this with your children and grandchildren as well. An adult that's paying too much attention, an adult that is giving too much praise, maybe wanting to spend too much time with a child or a young person. There's a lot of that behind closed doors, things that happen privately, and sometimes it's not just the bishop. It could be another Sunday school teacher or just another person in authority. It could be a school teacher. We've seen a lot of that come out lately, with school teachers being sexual predators. Recognizing the grooming, I think, for me, if I had known what that behavior looked like early on, I think I would have been able to protect myself. So now my children know what grooming looks like, and so when they start to see those behaviors in other adults, they already know to step away and step aside and go talk to an adult. And I think it's such a critical thing to teach our children. In my culture, I'm old. I'm 56 years old. So my parents didn't teach me about that. Of course, my parents wouldn't have. Not in our household anyway. But I think it's important that we not only understand it, but that we also don't present to someone as a predator. Because sometimes, I don't know about you, but I'm very affectionate. I'm very loving. I'm very open. People talk to me easily, and I generally listen. So I could also appear to be a predator because I invest in those relationships. But what are the key things that we want to look for? Can you think of any? What would a predator look like? Roger? Anybody? Yeah, we don't have a mask. We don't have a label on our head. We don't dress a certain way we don't come from a certain socioeconomic class or a certain ethnicity. The behaviors of a predator, the grooming practices of a predator, start very calm and very smooth because what they want is they want the trust of the person that they're going to victimize. And it's not only children, it's adults as well.
Thanks. We are going to go to Christine. She's going to cover unrighteous dominion.
As a child, of course, it was blind obedience, and I still think that's alive and well also. If somebody in authority tells you that this is right and this is what you need to do and this is how you need to act and speaks for you and takes your free agency away and actually your power and your control. And so as a child, I had no choice because I had to believe what was told to me and I had to survive. So, of course, I believed what general authorities told me how special I was and how unique I was. There was something wrong with me or this wouldn't have happened, on and on and on. But as I grew up and saw what my children had gone through, my daughter was sexually abused by our pediatrician. And we went through grooming, and he knew that we were a vulnerable family, and horrible things happened, and he got away with it. And that's another story. And my youngest son is gay also. And when he went on a mission trying to figure this out and always being told this was a horrible way to be, this was evil, this was sinful, so repressing it, going on a mission thinking that would make him better. And as he went on a mission, he started wandering around Helsinki, Finland by himself. He was so depressed. The mission president found out that he was actually by himself and not with a companion. And he brought him into the mission home, and he said to my son, "You are a disgrace. You are a disgrace to your family, to your God, and to me." That is what I call shaming. Being told you are a disgrace, you are being told you're less than, you are being told anything that labels you, and by obeying those in authority over you, you internalize that. Then you begin to think, I am a disgrace. I am horrible. My mission president told me something is even worse wrong with me than being gay. He started drinking. Horrible. He's had a horrible time in his life. And very sadly, Tuesday of this week, his husband passed away suddenly. So finally he was happy. Finally he was able to acknowledge and be proud of this fact. Finally get married and then have this happen. So this is a very difficult time also. But just listening and watching the way he was treated over his life and always not knowing what was wrong, because he couldn't tell, because he couldn't accept that in himself. And always thinking, why is he being teased? Why is he being calling names? I don't understand. And he wouldn't tell me because he knew it was deplorable. It finally came out after he got married and had two children. And I got a call one night and said, "Mom, I can't do this anymore." And he was a stay-at-home dad, so I thought, well, I'm sorry, that must be really hard with two little kids. He said, "No, Mom, we have to talk." And as I was listening, he just couldn't come out with it. And I said, "Honey, did you kill somebody? What did you do? What did you do?" And in my mind, it just came out. I said, "Well, at least you're not gay." And why and where that came from, but I had been so programmed as a mother to think that was despicable. And I remember saying to my friend, we lived near San Francisco, and we went in there one day, and we saw two men holding hands under a table. And I said to my friend, "I am so glad we don't have to deal with that." Never knowing I had a child who already was. So that comes from blind obedience, I believe, also. My daughter was sexually abused when she was 5 by our beloved pediatrician, who was the head of pediatrics at Primary Children's Hospital. He died last year with the most glowing, positive, loving obituary that you could ever imagine. Absolutely nothing about what he had done. There it is again. Just vacating, denying reality, absolutely horrible. She's had a very, very difficult life. She's been on the streets, she's been sexually abused, she's been in and out of drug rehab, on and on and on, all because of this. And I think of the hundreds and maybe thousands of lives this man affected by being in a position of trust, and having the blind obedience again. We need to question everybody in authority. I finally told about my abuse to Tom Monson and Gordon Hinckley, who happens to be my uncle. I actually went and told them I could not hold it in inside. They did the best they could, I'm sure, but they are not trained. They're not psychologists. People in authority do not have a right to give advice to anybody. They're not doctors. They're not psychologists. They're not counselors. You don't go to somebody and say, this is what you need to do. And this is what I was told. You need to put it past you and get on with your life. I was told this by both individuals. They're outstanding men and they're prophets. But to be told and taken away my reality and my life and telling me that I have complex PTSD, I have an anxiety disorder, I have all these things from my trauma, to put it past me. Would you tell someone with a brain tumor, just put it past you? I'm sorry. So there again, luckily, I don't believe what I'm told. Not me, not anymore. But other people would have and said, oh my gosh, what do? I've got to put it past me. What's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? I keep having dreams. I keep having triggers. I keep having flashbacks. What's wrong with me? I've got to do it. And then we get into the self-blame. I'm a bad person. Then we get into self-hatred. I am really horrible because I can't do what this person told me to do. And then we get into suicide. Because then you get to the point where you can't measure up because someone in authority told you to do something. And you aren't capable of doing it because it's a wrong thing to tell someone. You don't have the right. I'm sorry. You do not have the right, I don't care who you are, to tell anybody how they should live their life. You don't have the right. You are not the person. You are not walking in their shoes. You have not lived their life. I don't care if you're a prophet. I don't care who you are. Tom Monson said to me, I had this personal letter from him. I have been fasting and praying over what you told me. And I need to tell you now, you need to put it behind you.
Thank you,
Christine. Wow.
I'm going to go over for a second theology over morality and cultural behavior. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask the audience today to dig deep inside and find a little courage. Because what I'd like to show is that this problem is not just about active members of the church. If this problem has affected you and you are not an active member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in that you are going to church every single week, but you have been affected, would you please stand up? If you have been affected by the cultural behaviors of our church or have been abused or molested or shamed by a member of the church, or if you know someone who has been treated that way, would you stand up, please? Thank you. You can sit down. We live in Utah, and in other areas of the country where the communities are largely LDS, we cannot fool ourselves into thinking that this is only a Mormon problem. It is not. Our LGBT community is hurt because of how they are treated by members of the church. Members of our community that are not members of the church are shamed and shunned and treated horribly because of our cultural behavior. Culture is defined as the customary beliefs, social forms, and material traits of racial, religious, or social groups. They are passed down from generation to generation. They are taught, and they are spread everywhere. When we hear about cases where someone has been molested by someone in a school district, in a Mormon community,
And then they have been shamed and silenced, and that person has continued to prey on innocent people. It is a problem that is not just about the members of the church who are going to the temple and have the temple marriage and meeting all of those requirements. And we have to look at our behavior as members of the church. We have to look at our behavior as members of a community, and we have to put aside the theology that is overriding morality and ethics.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to turn the time over to Sam real quick, and he's going to cover the last causal effect of the tree root and kind of go into changes you're proposing also, Sam.
Unsafe policies. I'm concerned about one crappy policy of taking children behind closed doors all alone, an adult power figure with a child who is not fully developed, hardly at all. That's crappy enough right there. The rest of the world does not do this. And then we put on top of that, we layer on top of a behind-the-closed-door meeting all alone with a totally untrained man, we lay on top of that sexually explicit questions. So what are we working for? For just 10 words. We want 10 words to be added to the policies of our church. No one-on-one interviews, no sexually explicit questions ever. Yeah. I don't have any training, so I was one of those untrained bishops. I didn't ask anybody about masturbation or anything else. Why would I? Why would somebody do that? Well, I now know it's why people do that, but I'm not trained in any of the things that these women or have the experience these wonderful women have. I'm not super smart with regards to a lot of that stuff. But one thing I have a capacity for is to say that is, see, as you've been talking, I've never been a vulgar, had used profanity until the last couple of years. And now those words roll around in my head as you're talking. I don't know how to deal with it except to swear. No, I do know how to deal with it. I swear and I get on my horse and I'm going to charge and work to fix the goddamn problems that are harming our kids.
Yeah, we're going to open up for questions. Just to summarize a few of the points that we didn't get to touch on because we do want to have time for questions. We feel very strongly that there are mechanisms in place within the church that can be used to help survivors of abuse and help people in situations of trauma. Some that we came up with as a panel are the use of bulletin boards and posting community resources. Having the individual wards call a community liaison to collect the information, contact information of community resources so that they could be pointed in the direction of safe, ethical resources instead or as an option instead of maybe seeing their religious leader. Some others were, you know, if you're in a position where you're active in the church and you're teaching, they don't trust me to do that anymore, but if you're in a position where you're teaching other people, you know, teach a lesson on abuse, teach a lesson on consent, teach a lesson on healthy boundaries, teach a lesson on healthy communication, teach a lesson on empathy, teach a lesson on any topic that we don't hear about in the church, but we need to, and promote that. We just want to thank all of our panel guests today. They were wonderful, and we want to get to your questions, so that's what we're going to do right now.
We really only have like 7 minutes, so.
Okay, then I'll try to get right to this. I have family members when I talk about these things that I see are wrong, and part of the reason why I walked away, their response to me is, well, they'll be held accountable for all these things one day. I hear that's the answer. So I know how I feel about it. I want to hear from you because I imagine you hear that too. What do you say?
Okay, so personally for me, if somebody tells me I heard an apostle, not an apostle, a 70 tell me something very similar to that yesterday, I'm responsible now. Not in the eternities. I'm responsible not for anybody else, but for me. If I sit on the sideline and do nothing, damn me. I'm not going to sit there and do nothing. I'm responsible now.
And if I could add something to that, for your family members, and I know that this is a common thing, how do they think God is going to respond when they meet him face to face, and that is their excuse for not protecting children or supporting survivors?
For each of you that would care to speak to this, what does a healed church look like?
A healed church looks like we don't protect sexual predators. A healed church also looks like a place of safety and comfort and love. A healed church does not have a hotline that goes directly to Curtin McConkie to protect the ass of the church. I'm sorry, that was kind of crass, wasn't it?
You sounded like Sam.
I am Sam.
Yeah, I think she meant assets of the church. Yeah, I think real quick, just healed church. We did get a lot of pushback from this, interestingly enough, and I think it's an important point. You know, even though I may not meet the qualifications to be an active Mormon right now, if I see it's an unhealthy place for loved ones and family members, I want that to be healthy. It's no different than seeing a situation that is wrong and trying to make it right. And so you can still very much care about what happens in the church, even if your own activity level isn't up to par with the standards that the church sets. That would be my contribution.
I have 5 suggestions for that. I think that the church needs to have a hotline that goes directly for the members, that you don't have to go through the leaders, because it's often the leaders who are inflicting the trauma, and it disempowers those members because they have nowhere to go. And those who are on the receiving end of that trauma hotline need to understand the complexity and the magnitude of our church setup. The other thing that I would say is that members need to be able to go to any ward they want to, because it is such a hard thing when you have been traumatized in a ward and you have to go back to that place every single week. You are inflicting PTSD on that person. Let them worship how, where, and what they may. The next is, I think that there needs to be, every ward and state needs an ombudsman. An ombudsman, a definition for that, is a person who investigates and attempts to resolve complaints and problems between leaders and rank and file members. It needs to be independent of the local line of a priesthood authority. And I think there needs to be a church-wide panel of ombudsmen for more complicated cases such as McKenna's. I also think that there needs to be a professional training for our leaders. That training needs to include how to recognize and appropriately deal with psychological abuse. And the last one is that the LDS Church needs to support researchers in their efforts to bring the very real truth of church trauma in our church. And we are trying to help, so please bring us in and not make this about you, but about the well-being of this church.
One last thing that I would say is that if you know of anyone being abused or that has been abused, go to the police. Don't go to your bishop. Don't go to your stake president. Go to the people that in law enforcement who are trained to deal with that trauma. Get to the bottom of it, and then go to your bishop for the spiritual healing.
For the recording, the question asked had to do with the stance of the panelists on LGBTQ+ marriage.
Okay. You know, personally for myself, I feel like this goes directly to morality and being Christ-like. And the way that we treat people says more about who we are as disciples and followers of Jesus Christ than any policy or prejudice that can be offered. Yeah. So in reference to Josh's question as well, a healed church consists of members, every member who cares about the victim, who does not enable abusers, and who creates an environment where victims are believed and supported and loved without judgment and without shame.
Well, this has been a remarkably robust panel, and I can tell that there are still questions out there. Because of time, I would ask that you take your questions and speak to the panelists out in the hall. Let's thank our panelists one more time.